Chapter 10. The Witches of the Chalk. Hostility towards witches. In the lowlands and in the chalk country, witches do not receive the same respect as in Lancrey. There have been times when they were systematically persecuted, even burned. And though that no longer happens, many of the chalk people still distrust them, and are quick to blame them when there is trouble. So witches who go there are wary, and try not to attract attention. They wear ordinary clothes, and disguise their true craft behind a slightly more socially acceptable calling, such as teaching. That is why when Miss Perspicacia Tick visits the chalk or surrounding villages, she wears what looks like a simple black straw hat smothered in paper flowers, but is actually a collapsible stealth model. Press a spring, and it unfolds into the classic pointy shape. Among the paper flowers lurks a talking toad, which she refers to as her familiar, though so far it has not displayed any magical powers. Unlike the toad familiars of English witches in Wessex, which are so dangerous that the worst threat their mistress can utter is, "I'll set my toads on 'ee!" Miss Tick's equipment, too, looks far from witchy. She does her scrying by pouring a few drops of ink into rainwater in a cracked saucer, which she carries about in one of her many pockets. Also in her pockets are other insignificant objects. Twigs, loose beads, string, a reel of cotton, a holed stone, a few feathers, scraps of coloured paper. These she can thread together to make a shamble, a powerful magic detector and projector, which looks a bit like a particularly complicated cat's cradle, a bit like a broken set of puppet strings, and a bit like a very untidy dream catcher. To do this requires high skill in making string figures, an art practiced in various parts of the multiverse, and often linked to myths and magic. On Earth, Germans call it Das Hexenspiel, the witch's game. A shamble won't work if you buy it ready-made. You have to make your own, fresh every time, out of whatever there happens to be in your pockets. In the centre, you put something alive, an egg, say, or a beetle or small worm, and pull the strings, and as the objects twirl past or even through one another, the device works. In the presence of really powerful magic, it may explode. But if you pull the right bit of string, it all falls apart in a moment and becomes just a small pile of harmless rubbish. Nothing suspicious, nothing that makes people say, "Witch." Because once people think you're a witch, things can go terribly, terribly wrong. As they did for poor old Mrs. Snappily, who died in the snow one winter, but who probably wasn't a witch at all. As Tiffany Aching tells Miss Tick, Mrs. Snappily used to live alone in a strange cottage in the woods, and had no teeth, and talked to herself. And she had a cat, and she squinted. So when a young boy went riding in those woods one summer day, and never came back, people said she'd killed him, and maybe cooked him in her oven too. And so after he vanished, they went to her cottage, and they looked in the oven, and they dug up her garden, and they threw stones at her old cat until it died, and they turned her out of her cottage, and piled up all her old books in the middle of the room, and set fire to them, and burned the place to the ground, and everyone said she was an old witch. From the Wee Free Men. To make matters worse, this lost boy was the Baron's son, and the Baron, whose family had held the chalk for generations without ever changing their minds about anything, was full of taken-for-granted prejudices. He too blamed Mrs. Snappily, and gave orders that nobody was to have anything to do with her, and that any witch found in the country should be tied up and thrown in a pond. The old woman managed to live through the autumn, begging and stealing food here and there, and sleeping where she could. But there came a cold night when no one would open their doors to her, and it snowed, and by morning she was dead. Thankfully, such small rural tragedies are now rare on Discworld, but they were common on Earth until modern times. As late as the 1920s, in one Sussex village, there was an old widow called Betsy Shadlow, who was forced into isolation by the fears and suspicions of her neighbours. She was a wicked old woman, they said, and had powerful books with a deal of evil written in them. She lived alone and in poverty, and was crippled with rheumatism. But nobody would help her dig up her potatoes for fear of what she might do to them. When she went to the farm to buy milk, the farmer wouldn't let her pass the gate in case she bewitched the cows, so she had to stay in the road and yell until somebody heard her. There came a time when people realized that they hadn't seen her around for a couple of weeks, so the rector called at her cottage and found her sick in bed, too ill to move. The man who told her story to the Sussex County Magazine in 1943 remembered how it all ended. The workhouse people came next day and took her away. One of the head men stayed behind to sort out her belongings. She hadn't much furniture, but they found a pile of books. My neighbour, who was very fond of reading and very curious as well, asked the official if he could have them, or at least read them. But we said it wasn't right. And anyway, we didn't want anyone else learning the secrets and playing us up. Betsy Shadlow was trouble enough, and we asked the workhouse chap to burn them. He looked at them and said they were rubbish anyway. It's a strange thing, but when they came to set fire to all the unwanted stuff from the cottage, along with those books, we lookers-on saw green flames coming from the fire. The Baron's notion that the thing to do with witches is to throw them into ponds must be one of those thought particles drifting through the multiverse and taking root in any suitable mind. It echoes a practice once common in many countries of the earth, the swimming test. It began in the Middle Ages as a way of discovering whether someone was or was not a witch, and reached its peak in the first half of the 17th century. The suspect would be tied up, hands to feet, and thrown in. It was believed that if she was guilty, water, being a pure and holy element, would reject her, and she would remain floating on the surface. If she was innocent, she would sink, and, hopefully, someone would haul her out before she drowned. Though popular, this was not actually legal, and the vast majority of lawyers and church leaders refused to accept it as evidence in court. One famous writer who did believe in the test was King James VI of Scotland and the First of England, who linked it with the idea that witches had rejected the Christian faith in which they had been baptized. "So it appears that God hath appointed, for a supernatural sign of the monstrous impiety of witches, that the water shall refuse to receive into her bosom those who have shaken off them the sacred water of baptism, and wilfully refuse the sacred benefit thereof." There came a time when all laws against witchcraft were dropped, and people could no longer take a woman to court if they thought her spells had harmed them. So, remembering the old ways, village mobs sometimes took matters into their own hands by swimming her themselves, not as a test, but as a punishment. Even in Victorian England, there were one or two cases where people died of this, by drowning or by pneumonia. In view of the Baron's decree, it is fortunate that Miss Perspicacia Tick is good at untying knots with her teeth and swimming underwater, and can lurk under the weeds breathing air through a hollow reed. Regrettably, some things don't change. Terry recalls a case in the USA some years ago when a somewhat new-age lady got a visit from her local sheriff after a neighbour reported that she was saying spells in her garden. She'd been singing a Christian hymn in Latin. Witches have a duty. As in Lancrey, so on the Chalk, a witch has a duty to her land and her people. It is because young Tiffany Aching has an instinctive ability to accept responsibility, to cope with threats to herself and others, that she is a natural-born witch. As the Kelder of the Wee Free Men tells her,
"You're the Hagnu, the witch that guards the edges and the gateways. So was your granny, although she wouldn't ever call herself one."
Granny Aching had lived and died as a shepherd. The chalk and flint were in her bones, the sky was her hat, and the wind her cloak. All spring and summer, she stayed out on the hills, sleeping in her old wheeled shepherding hut, which could be dragged across the downs to follow the flocks. Tiffany knew, probably by reading The Good Child's Book of Fairy Tales, that any old woman who lived in a house that moved about must be at least slightly a witch. She was sure of this, even though she had never heard of Mrs. Gogol, the swamp witch in Genua, whose hut puddled along on duck's feet, let alone Baba Yaga in Russian fairy tales, whose cottage stood on hen's legs and spun round and round. Granny Aching was a supremely skillful and conscientious shepherd, with all the toil and responsibility this entails. One would see Granny Aching's light weaving slowly across the downs on freezing, sparkly nights, or in storms like a raging war, saving lambs from the creeping frost, or rams from the precipice. She froze and struggled and tramped through the night for idiot sheep that never said thank you, and would probably be just as stupid tomorrow, and get into the same trouble again. And she did it because not doing it was unthinkable. From the Wee Free Men. She used no magic, though some shepherd's tricks look like magic if you don't know how they're done. But she had wisdom and authority, and sometimes anger too. She saw to it that where there was injustice there would be a reckoning, since them as can do has to do for them as can't, and someone has to speak up for them as has no voices. Within 2 or 3 years of her death, the memory of her had grown into something larger than life, something like a spirit of the downs. There were always buzzards over the chalk. The shepherds had taken to calling them Granny Aiken's chickens, and some of them called clouds, like those up there today, Granny's little lambs. And Tiffany knew that even her father called the thunder Granny Aiken cussin'. And it was said that some of the shepherds, if wolves were troublesome in the winter, or a prize ewe had got lost, would go to the site of the old hut in the hills and leave an ounce of jolly sailor tobacco, just in case. No wonder that when monsters and elves from another world appear in the chalk country, Tiffany's first thought is that Granny would have known how to deal with them. But Granny is dead. It is now young Tiffany who must become the witch's shepherd, guarding the borders, driving invaders away, keeping an eye on things. She has a duty. Becoming a witch. How does a girl become a witch? First, she must have some natural inborn talent, even if she does not yet realize it. Here, heredity can help, and in Tiffany's case it does. The Aikins, like the Weatherwaxes, have witching in their blood. It might also be significant that she is the seventh daughter. On the Earth, it certainly would be, for in that universe, many a magical healer and fortune-teller has found that being a seventh son, or daughter, is good publicity. But the supreme magical number on the Discworld is 8, not 7, so it is usually the eighth son, or daughter, who is born with power, as we learn in Equal Rights and Sorcery. The really unmistakable sign that Tiffany is destined to be a witch is her name. A sign all the more powerful for being the result of sheer chance. If there is such a thing as chance. In the languages of the Discworld, Tiffany has no meaning, but the Kelder of the Wee Free Men tells her that in their old speech, a Celtic tongue, learned in another universe, its true form is Tir Fa Thoin, meaning land under wave. But in the language of Earth, it comes from the same Greek root as Epiphany, meaning revelation of God. Chalk hills are land which was once under the waves, land formed from the shells of countless millions of sea creatures. Knowing this, and knowing what her name means, is the core of Tiffany's power. She saw herself, set her boots firmly on the turf, and then, like someone rising from the clouds of a sleep, she felt the deep, deep time below her. She sensed the breath of the downs and the distant roar of ancient, ancient seas trapped in millions of tiny shells. She thought of Granny Aching, under the turf, becoming part of the chalk again, part of the land under wave. She felt as if huge wheels of time and stars were turning slowly around her. She opened her eyes, and then, somewhere inside, opened her eyes again. She heard the grass growing, and the sound of worms below the turf. She could feel the thousands of little lives around her, smell all the scents on the breeze, and see all the shades of the night. The wheels of stars and years, of space and time, locked into place. She knew exactly where she was, and who she was, and what she was. From the We Free Men. However, even if you are born with an aptitude for magic, there are still skills to be learned, and it is not wise to try to learn witching all by yourself. Get one little thing wrong, and you're stuck among dangers you don't understand. Even if you make no mistakes, you'll be desperately lonely. Unless you can meet people of your own sort, you may end up mad. Or bad. Things aren't so bad for boys, who are potential wizards, since they can go to unseen university. Occasionally, in those few times and places in the multiverse where girls have been allowed to study the same thing as their brothers, there has been some talk of boarding schools for young witches, and even of co-educational establishments. But on the disc, there is nothing like that. When Miss Tick tells Tiffany that, yes, there is indeed such a school, very magical, nowhere else quite like it, this is a trick or test. The true school, as Tiffany soon understands, is all around you. Once you know how to open your eyes, and then open them again. As for the detailed skills of the craft, they are passed on from elderly witches to young ones, on a one-to-one basis, together with some very necessary guidance and protection. It is Miss Tick's responsibility, as a secret witchfinder, to pick out girls with talent and make suitable arrangements for them. So when Tiffany was 11, she left her home in the Chalk Country and travelled to the mountains, where she went into service with Miss Level, partly as a maid and partly as an apprentice. She learned about herbs and broomsticks and tried patiently to make a shamble. She accompanied Miss Level round the villages and isolated farms, doing medicine and midwifery, and learned that, though a witch never expects payment and never asks for it, there is a constant interchange of gifts and favours. There was nothing romantic about this work, nothing dramatic, no magic potions to cure the sick in an instant. Witchcraft, said Miss Level, was mostly about helping people by doing quite ordinary things. This has been the task of the true wise woman in every universe, and we can assume, though evidence is lacking, that girls who became wise women on Earth learned their skills and duties by some similar informal apprenticeship. However, cures and advice are more likely to be accepted if they sound magical, as Tiffany learned. Miss Level had been carefully telling one family that their well was much too close to their privy, so the water was full of tiny, tiny creatures which were making the children sick. They listened politely, but did nothing. Then Granny Weatherwax visited them, and told them the illness was caused by goblins, who were attracted to the smell of the privy, and that very day the man of the house and his friends began digging a new well at the other end of the garden. A story gets things done. Yet there was part of Tiffany's mind which hankered for power and drama and picturesque paraphernalia. This is a very common weakness in young witches, and Tiffany meets one group of girls who practice the higher magic.
Magic with a K, said Tiffany. Magic.
That's deliberate, said Anna Grammer coldly. If we are to make any progress at all, we must distinguish the higher magic from the everyday sort.
The everyday sort of magic, said Tiffany.
Exactly. None of that mumbling in hedgerows for us. Proper sacred circles, spells written down, a proper hierarchy, not everybody running around doing whatever they feel like. Real wands, not bits of grubby stick. Professionalism, with respect. Absolutely no warts. That's the only way forward.
From a Hatful of Sky. Anna Grammer has learned this approach from Mrs. Lettice Earwig, a tall, thin witch who wears so much silver that she gleams, uses words like avatar and sigil, and writes books. This has earned her Granny Weatherwax's heartfelt contempt.
That's just wizard magic with a dress on. And she thinks you can become a witch by going shopping, are two of Granny's milder comments. Anna Grammer runs a coven of young girls whom she bullies and sneers at and chivvies through complex ceremonies involving such things as the Wand of Air, the Cauldron of the Sea, the Shriven Chalice, the Circlet of Infinity. They all go in for robes and occult jewellery and patronise the very expensive shop of Zack Zack Strong in the Arm, a dwarf craftsman who supplies everything the higher Magician might require. Wands of metal or rare woods, elaborately pretty ready-made shambles, crystal balls, luxurious cloaks, star-spangled hats, rings, pendants, your personal grimoire, Book of Night or Book of Shadows, bound in heavy leather, with an actively rolling eye on the cover. It is really remarkable how similar ideas spring up across the multiverse. On the Earth, groups like this have become common over the past 100 years or so. There, too, some of them insist on an eccentric spelling for what they do, calling it magic, M-A-G-I-C-K, to make sure that nobody mistakes it for that boring, old-fashioned folk magic. They go in for formal initiations, oaths, grades, and hierarchies, and their founders and leaders, generally men, are notably authoritarian. They take grandiose names for themselves, their organizations, their ritual ceremonies, and the objects used in ritual. And the Zack Zacks of our world do very good business. Well, whatever. But one instinctively feels that Granny's every stick is a wand, every puddle is a crystal ball, is closer to the truth. Or a truth, at least. See me. The most remarkable of Tiffany's abilities was one which she ought really to have mentioned to Miss Tick, but she didn't, being too young and inexperienced to know how unusual and how risky it was. Closing her eyes and concentrating, she would say, "See me." Then, reopening her eyes, she would find herself standing a few feet away from herself. She had walked out of her own body, and now her detached self could move around, looking at her physical self from every side. When she had seen all she wanted, she would say, "See me not," and the two selves were instantly reunited. As a child, Tiffany simply thought of this as a handy little trick to use if you didn't have a proper mirror. She had no notion that it is the basis of borrowing, that supreme skill of great witches. Still less did she suspect that if you just walk out of your body and leave it there, without taking proper precautions, there are creatures only too ready to move in and take control. This ability, or something very like it, has been observed elsewhere in the multiverse, though not under the deliberate control of those who have it. One form is the near-death experience, much discussed nowadays on the Earth. People who are semi-conscious from heart failure or anesthetic and almost on the point of death feel the mind detaching itself from the inert body and floating upwards. They can watch the body from above and see what is going on around it, but eventually are reunited with it and regain consciousness. Older earthly sources speak of the soul rather than the mind separating itself from the sleeping body and wandering off on its own. According to folk tradition, it is possible for an observer to see this happening, for the soul emerges in visible form as a small animal, an insect, or a puff of smoke. This is said to have happened once to King Guntram of the Franks, who ruled Burgundy from 561 to 592. The story was written down some 200 years later. One day, Guntram felt tired while out hunting and took a nap under a tree, while a courtier kept watch. This man saw that while the king was asleep, a little animal slithered out of his mouth and went down to a tiny brook, where it ran to and fro on the bank, looking for a way to cross. Amused at this, the courtier laid his sword across the brook. The little creature crossed at once and disappeared into a hole on the opposite bank. After a bit, it returned across the sword bridge and slipped back into the king's mouth. Then Guntram woke up and said to his companion, "I must tell you what a strange dream I've just had. I saw a very large, very wide river, and across it a great iron bridge had been built. I crossed the bridge and went into a cave in the side of a towering mountain, and it was filled with treasure. Then the courtier told the king what had actually happened, and they decided to dig into the bank of the brook, and sure enough, there was a treasure buried there. It is important that no one should touch or shake or shift the unconscious body while its soul is away, because if the soul cannot find its way back, the person will die. Making a myth of oneself. Tiffany's next post is as apprentice to an extremely odd, nay terrifying, witch named Miss Eumenides Treason. 113 years old, quite blind and quite deaf. Yet these disabilities scarcely bother her, because she is skilled at borrowing and uses the eyes and ears of any nearby animal as if they were her own. On occasion, she even borrows Tiffany's eyes, which is rather irritating of her. Whereas Miss Tick is a stealth witch, Miss Treason flaunts witchery in every detail of her lifestyle. All witches like wearing black, but she has gone further. The walls and floors in her cottage are black, and so, of course, are her candles. She keeps black goats and black hens. Even cheeses must be coated with black wax. Everything has been carefully crafted to match images stamped deeply into the human psyche by the force of narrativium. Since it is her aim to turn herself into a myth in life and in death, she knows exactly how to do it. Every witch has her particular skill, and Miss Treason's is to deliver justice. People would come to her from miles around with disputes about land or cows or rent or legacies, and she would sit in judgment. So, how does the image fit the role? First, blindness. Everyone knows that when justice is personified, she wears a blindfold, and so does Miss Treason, a black one, naturally. So indeed does blind Io, chief of the gods, who has blank skin where his eyes should be, and an impressive number of detached eyeballs floating round him. It is not known whether Miss Treason is deliberately mocking him. It is not impossible, for witches don't have much respect for gods. What is quite certain is that she strikes terror into the hearts of disputants. When she removes the blindfold from her pearly grey eyes and prepares to give judgment, saying,
"I have heard. Now I shall see. I shall see what is true."
Her blind eyes seem to look right into the soul. People say if you lie to her, you'll be dead in a week. Then there is her name, Eumenides, which she must have found in the pages of Chaffinch's Ancient and Classical Mythology, one of her favourite books, crammed full with bookmarks. On the earth, in ancient Greece, this was the polite name for the Erinyes, or avenging furies, terrifying goddesses, whose function was to hound the guilty to death. It literally means sweet-tempered ladies, and was meant to be flattering to them and reassuring to us. But nobody was ever fooled by that. Her chosen hobby is weaving, which, like the spinning of the fates, is a traditional metaphor for the way supernatural beings decide human destinies. One tale from the earth, the medieval Icelandic Njal saga, tells how 12 Valkyries were seen setting up a gruesome loom just before the great battle of Clontarf between Vikings and Irishmen in 1014. As they worked, they sang, we weave a web of war, human guts our warp and weft, skulls our loom weights, spears our shuttles, swords to beat the blood-stained cloth. We decide who lives, who dies. We weave a web of war. Next, her birds. At the time Tiffany was living with Miss Treason, she kept 2 ravens, which had once worked for blind Io. One would sit on each side of her head on a wooden perch, which fitted like a yoke across her shoulders. The effect was very witchy, and mythic too. No doubt she had been reading about the Norse god Odin and his ravens, Huginn and Muninn, thought and memory, which perched on his shoulders and told him everything they had seen as they flew round Middle-earth. Before the ravens, she had kept a pet jackdaw. There are no links between jackdaws and justice, but good precedents for their use as magical familiars. The medieval English chronicler, William of Malmesbury, wrote in his Gesta Regum Anglorum, 1125, of a witch who had lived at Berkeley in Gloucestershire, some 60 years before his time, in the year 1063. She was skilled in interpreting omens, and had a tame jackdaw as her very great favourite. One day the bird chattered more loudly than usual, and she turned pale, knowing this was a warning that her own death was at hand. A Discworld witch wouldn't mind knowing this, but the Witch of Berkeley had made a pact with the devil, so for her it was not good news. In much more recent times, in the 1960s to be precise, a well-known witch in the New Forest in Hampshire, Mrs. Sybil Leake, would always appear in public with a tame jackdaw, called Hotfoot Jackson, perching on her shoulder. Very eye-catching, but, like Miss Treason, she did have to put up with mess down the back of her cloak. Myth-making is a communal activity, even if most people involved don't see that that's what they're doing. It's built up from fears, rumours, thrills and stories, all driven by powerful doses of narrativium. Miss Treason takes a keen interest in the process, since she has a reputation to keep up. She asks Tiffany,
"Have you heard the stories about me, child?"
That you have a demon in the cellar," Tiffany answered, "that you eat spiders and get visited by kings and princes, and that any flower planted in your garden blooms black."
"Oh, do they say so?"
said Miss Treason, looking delighted.
"I haven't heard that last one. How nice! And did you hear that I walk around at night in the dark time of the year and reward those who have been good citizens with a purse of silver? But if they have been bad, I slit open their bellies with my thumbnail, like this."
Tiffany leapt backwards as a wrinkled hand twisted her round, and Miss Treason's yellow thumbnail scythed past her stomach. The old woman looked terrifying.
"No! No, I haven't heard that one," she gasped, pressing up against the sink.
"What? And it was a wonderful story, with real historical antecedents," said Miss Treason, her vicious scowl becoming a smile. "And the one about me having a cow's tail?"
"A cow's tail? No."
"Really? How very vexing. I fear the art of storytelling has got into a pretty bad way in these parts. I really shall have to do something."
From Wintersmith. It is to be hoped that she did, for they are indeed splendid stories, and it would be a great pity if they were forgotten. Their historical antecedents have deep roots in the Scandinavian and German-speaking parts of the earth. The cow's tail is characteristic of elf women in the mountain forests of Norway and Sweden. From in front they look beautiful, and many a human huntsman or charcoal burner has been seduced into making love with one of them. But if he gets a glimpse of her back, he will see either that it is hollow, mossy and rotten like an old tree stump, or that it ends in a long, dirty cow's tail. If he runs off in horror, she will chase him, and if she catches him, she will tear him to bits. They are not to be trifled with, these forest elf women. As for the stomach splitting, here Miss Treason is surely thinking of some Discworld equivalent of a famous supernatural hag known as Frau Holler in Germany and Frau Perkta or Frau Berta in Bavaria, Austria and Switzerland. Stories about her go back at least 1,000 years. Some say she lives on a mountain peak, but others say up in the sky. When it snows in the human world, everyone knows that she's shaking out her feather beds until the feathers drift about in the wind. In midwinter, during the 12 days of Christmas, she comes to Earth and travels round the countryside, checking on whether children have been good and obedient, and whether the village girls have worked hard on the farms and spun as much flax or wool as they should have done in the course of the year. Then comes Twelfth Night itself, sometimes called Perkta Nacht, and reckoned to be the last night of the year. At midnight, she comes into every house. Those who have been good and done their work properly may find a silver coin in their shoes or in the milking pail. But as for those who haven't, she will slit their bellies open, remove the contents, and fill them up with chopped straw, pebbles, and dirt. Then she sews them up again, using a plowshare as a needle and an iron chain as thread. Another notion which Miss Treason picked up from the tales of Earth is that of the external soul. A good example is the legendary Russian evil wizard Kostchei the Deathless, who placed his life or soul in an egg. The egg was inside a duck, and the duck was inside a hare. And the hare was lying in a great hollow log, floating in a pond in a forest on an island, far, far away from Kostchei's palace. Miss Treason's version is less complicated. She wears a heavy iron clock on her belt, and is always winding it up. There is a story in the villages that this clock is her heart, which she has used ever since her first heart died.
"Miss Treason," said Tiffany severely, "did you make up the story about your clock?"
"Of course I did, and it's a wonderful bit of folklore, a real corker. Miss Treason and her clockwork heart. Might even become a myth if I'm lucky. They'll remember Miss Treason for thousands of years."
She is brilliant at stage setting, too. Her all-black cottage is thick with cobwebs, though there are no spiders to be seen. The black candles by the loom are set in two skulls, and dribble wax all down them. One skull is carved with the Greek word for guilt, the other with the Greek word for innocence. This is the kind of thing people expect of her, and it all helps to build her reputation. But the skulls hold a secret. There is a label underneath, and it says,
"Ghastly Skull Number 1, price $2.99, The Boffo Novelty and Joke Shop, Number 4, 10th Egg Street, Ankh-Morpork. If it's a laugh, it's a Boffo."
The cobwebs also came from there, and Boffo does masks and warts and green bubbling cauldrons too. So, where is the difference between Miss Treason buying skulls from Boffo's catalogue and Mrs. Earwig buying silver pendants and crystals at Zack Zack's shop? The point is this. Mrs. Earwig thinks that power comes from elaborate devices, and to think this is to misunderstand the whole essence of the craft. But Miss Treason knows that you don't need a wand or a shamble or even a pointy hat to be a witch, but that it helps a witch if she puts on a show. Give people what they expect to see. It's all a form of headology, like the hat or Granny Weatherwax's bottle of coloured water. That way, you get respect. Looking back on her life's work as death approaches, Miss Treason muses,
"Oh, my silly people. Anything they don't understand is magic. They think I can see into their hearts. But no witch can do that. Not without surgery, at least. No magic is needed to read their little minds, though. I've known them since they were babes. I see their lies and excuses and fears. They never grow up. Not really."
"I'm sure they'll miss you," said Tiffany.
"Ha! I'm the wicked old witch girl. They feared me and did what they were told. They feared joke skulls and silly stories. I chose fear. I knew they'd never love me for telling them the truth, so I made certain of their fear. No, they'll be relieved to hear the witch is dead."
As a Roman general said long ago, "Oderint dum metuant." Let them hate me, so long as they fear me. If you want to be remembered for generations in folk tradition, whether as a hero, a saint, or a sage, a good death scene is vitally important. Now, one of the minor benefits of being a witch is that you know, months or even years in advance, exactly when you are going to die, so you can stage manage the event to perfection. On Earth, legend says that exceptionally holy people have this privilege too. Having done all the obvious things, cleaned the cottage, made a will, destroyed any embarrassing old letters or spells still lying around, you can throw a really good going-away party. This is like a wake, but with yourself as guest of honour, still taking a keen interest. People, especially other witches, come from miles around to enjoy the food. As Nanny Og says, you cannot go wrong with a ham roll. And to let it be discreetly known that they have always rather admired your brass candlesticks, or your big carving dish with the blue and gold border. It saves a great deal of squabbling if you, the soon-to-be-late witch, can organize the distribution of these little mementos yourself. And then, when everyone has gone home and there's been a few hours of peace and quiet, you just head for the garden where some helpful neighbour has dug a neat grave. In Miss Treason's case, it was the Knack McFeagles who did the job. Climb down into it, watched by an awed but appreciative audience of village folk, lie down carefully, and wait. It is a fine thing to be able to organise your own rite of passage, and Miss Treason pulls it off perfectly. And she succeeds in her aim of turning herself into a myth. Within a few weeks of her death, her grave was covered with scraps of paper, pegged down with sticks, each bearing a message. "Miss Treason, please keep my boy Joe safe at sea. Miss Treason, I'm going bald. Please help. Miss Treason, please find our girl Becky what run away. I'm sorry." Even though there was a new young witch dispensing justice, and quite impressively too in her own way, people still put their trust and hopes in what they knew. They brought their small prayers to Miss Treason's grave, just as the shepherds of the chalk left packets of jolly sailor tobacco where Granny Aching's old shepherding hut used to stand. They didn't write their petitions down, but they were there all the same, floating in the air. "Granny Aching, who herds the clouds in the blue sky, please watch my sheep. Granny Aching, cure my son. Granny Aching, find my lambs." And so a witch or a shepherdess can indeed turn into a myth, a local saint, maybe even a goddess. It's been known before, and it still goes on, and not just on the Discworld. Go visit Biddy Early's cottage.